morning's speaker is Patrick Christie, who's an associate professor in the School of Marine Affairs and the Jackson School of International Studies here at the University of Washington, and he's a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation. And he's led various comparative socio-ecological research projects in the U.S., Philippines, Indonesia, and Nicaragua to inform the practice of marine resource management. And he's particularly interested in the human dimensions of marine conservation, deploying marine protected areas, ecosystem-based management, and conservation fishing technologies. And he draws from his 3 years of experience living in the Philippine fishing community, implementing a community-based marine protected area as a Peace Corps volunteer. And he's an editor-in-chief for the Journal of Coastal Management. And he has a bachelor's degree in zoology from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, a master's in conservation biology, and a doctorate in environmental sociology and policy from the University of Michigan. And today he's going to tell us about Philippine marine aquatic resources, the best and worst situation of the world. So, Patrick.
Thank you very much for the introduction. So it's really nice to come up here to this part of campus and talk to people at the Water Center. And I'm assuming that a lot of your presentations in this seminar series are about freshwater ecology, although there might be some salty water mixed in with a lot. Today I'll be talking primarily about Southeast Asia and the Philippines and the issues surrounding marine aquatic resources management. This work is mostly the work that I've been conducting as part of this Pew Fellows 3 year grant. It's an interesting fellowship because it encourages people, academics and conservationists alike, to engage both in conservation activities and in research simultaneously. So I'm going to talk today about the Philippine context and what's going on there with the oceans and conservation work. I'll be talking about interesting policy responses in this context. And I'll be talking about the research I've been conducting as I was introduced. You know, like for a lot of people, Peace Corps changes your life. I went into Peace Corps as a conservation biologist thinking that environmental management was mostly informed by the discipline of ecology, and that it was about realizing recommendations of conservation biologists. And of course, after 3 years of working with local communities, I quickly came to realize that in fact is not at all the case. That people in these developing country contexts are faced with a myriad of problems and challenges, and that what it really takes is an understanding of where ecology and natural sciences meet just the social sciences, and how can you develop strategies of resource management that will resonate with local peoples. And one could maybe imagine that those things are only relevant in the third world, but in fact, I work also in Puget Sound with the tribes and the like, and we realize very quickly that if we want things like the Puget Sound Partnership or marine protected areas to work in Puget Sound, we really need to get our head around how people perceive their environment. What do they want in their world? And so I hope you're not going to just relegate this research to Southeast Asia in your mind and say, well, that's really interesting, and that's just relevant for the third world context. I would encourage you to think about how this kind of work and how these methodologies and conclusions may be relevant to the world around us here, even in Puget Sound. So, having said that, I went to this country for 3 years, and this is a country of 7,000 islands. It has a very interesting history. Beginning in the 16th century, it was colonized by the Spanish. It was ceded to the United States following the Spanish-American War. The old adage, somewhat in jest and somewhat tragically, one would suggest 300 years of the Spanish, 50 years of Hollywood. If anyone has traveled in the Philippine context, you'll realize that this is perhaps very distinct in Southeast Asia, that the take-home message as a visitor to this context is that it's a heavily colonized country. The cultural references are to Britney Spears, to plastic-made Tupperware, to television. Over 120 million text messages are sent per day in the country. People are wired, they're engaged in Western culture, but they're an interesting hybrid of Asian and Western cultures. It's also a very diverse place. It's, as I mentioned, has 7,000 islands. It has, it's the epicenter of marine biodiversity on the planet. It is the Amazon of the ocean. It's also culturally diverse, and people measure that by linguistic diversity, over 170 languages. So think about this in terms of resource management and the complexities of trying to make plans for conservation. When people, in fact, while they speak Malay-based languages, of course, it's a very culturally diverse context. Turn this down a little bit. Here's some background some basic information about the environment. It's about the size of Arizona. It has extensive coral reef ecosystems. About 5% of the world's coral reefs are found in the Philippines. Has an extensive coastline. It's also a highly impoverished context, measured by the Philippine government. About 40% of the of people in the country living under poverty. Of course, their measures of poverty are much more severe than ours. And one of the legacies, of course, of colonialism and neocolonialism is the extreme and crushing debt. About twice the national budget, about $53 billion in 2008. Of course, a lot of people would look to the Philippines and focus on this last statistic here, which is that it's a heavily populated country. So if you look at the world from sort of a Malthusian, too many people in the world to feed, of course you're going to overexploit the planet's resources if you have 98 million people living in a place the size of Arizona. I would challenge you to think that it's a little more complicated than that. And I would encourage you to think about the issues of colonialism, and I'll talk a little bit about this. So while, of course, there is high population levels in a small place, the story is much more complex than just a straight Malthusian, too many people to feed. And one of the important metrics or one of the important variables to consider is this. Up until 1986, the country was ruled by one of the worst dictators in the world, supported by the U.S. government, Marcos, for the name Marcos. Thousands and thousands of people were killed. It took a People's Power Revolution to unseat this terrible individual. And through such remarkable instances as people literally going to the soldiers and offering them peace offerings and saying, look, you know that this individual is not good for our country, and we can do it better. And they have been inspirational for much of Asia. The Philippines has been inspirational for much of Asia in this regard. Now, what does this have to do with the environment? I would suggest that the form of resource management in the country is heavily informed by the political reality of the Philippines. The Philippines is renowned in the marine conservation community as the place that is at the leading edge of collaborative management, participatory resource management. I'll talk about this a bit later on. It's after Ferdinand Marcos was ousted and Cory Aquino came into power in 87. By 1990, they had passed something called the Local Government Code. And what's relevant for the ocean and aquatic resources is that the Local Government Code stated that municipal governments, the mayor and the Sangguniang Bayan, or the municipal council, and communities, the barangay, have jurisdiction to 15 kilometers offshore. It's incredible because, of course, most coral reefs are found within 15 kilometers. And what it also means from a governance point of view is an incredibly decentralized decision-making process. So this is like, so I live on Vashon Island, right? It's as if Vashon Island could say, we now control the water on Vashon Island. If we want to set up marine conservation protocols on Vashon Island, it is a decision of Vashon Island. End of discussion. You don't need to talk to the state. You don't need to talk to the feds. It's a decision of the people who live in that location. So it represents the most decentralized ocean governance system in the planet, and I would suggest it's directly derivative of the political struggles that exist in the country, because prior and during the Marcos regime, Ferdinand Marcos, like what happened in Indonesia with other dictators, everything was run from Manila. You couldn't do anything without the approval of Marcos. It also represents certain challenges for large-scale conservation as well, because there's a lot of people involved. So this is the kind of stuff that I study. So I went to the Philippines and Peace Corps thinking I was really fascinated with marine biodiversity. And what I really became fascinated with the people who use the ocean resources. The woman who's gleaned resources off the reef at low tide, about 40% of people's protein comes from old women and children gleaning invertebrates off the reefs, people using traditional fishing technologies, and of course there's us, the people who arrived there to play and to spend a lot of money. So all of these are part of the human dimension story in the oceans, and I could put up a myriad of slides, but the fact of the matter is that people are having a tremendous effect on the world's oceans. There are now, according to Van Halpern, down at UC Santa Barbara, essentially no pristine areas of the oceans left. The frontier has been closed. And this is a good example of it. This is the kind of place that I work. This is an aerial shot of a typical bay in the Philippines. It is a highly humanized environment. There are people here involved in paddy aquaculture. There are urban areas. There's deforestation leading to siltation. Coral reefs are incredibly sensitive to because they have a symbiotic algae, zooxanthellae, in the flesh of the coral that basically provides most of the food to the corals. If those corals are covered by silt, they die, and essentially as a permanent state, much more lasting than many other negative effects on coral reefs. The fact of the matter is that coastal areas in the Philippines and in most of Southeast Asia are highly humanized locations. And so we need to be thinking, getting back to the conservation issue and how to do this well, the resource management issue, how to do this in such a humanized environment. I would suggest that, again, look at Puget Sound. Look at the maps of the land use planning changes in Puget Sound. The frontier is essentially closed in Puget Sound as well, obviously. So if you want to work in a context where you can apply certain discrete interventions and expect to have certain discrete responses from governance and peoples and the like, don't work in the Philippines. This place is a morass of problems. It has to do with open access, reading Ostrom and others around common property. Basically, it's a free-for-all. If you can afford to buy a fishing net or buy a boat, you can go fishing. There are no fishing licenses, no effort restriction protocols, generally speaking, some spatial ones, which I'll talk about. But generally, it's most fishing is considered sort of the occupation of the poorest of the poor. Many in places that I work in, densities of fishers are commonly around 60 per kilometer of shoreline. Okay? So it's an open access regime. People are fishing with fishing methodologies like dynamite and cyanide. There's high population levels. You've got effluent. Manila, about 12 million people, has almost no sewer system. That's a lot of effluent going into the ocean. So it's a very complicated place, and if you want to work on marine resource management in this context, you better be comfortable working across boundaries. Startling fact, for a place reliant on marine resources, the biomass of fish stocks in several important fishery bays in the Philippines, less than 10% of what it was in the 1950s. Daniel Pauly, UBC, has referred to this as Malthusian overfishing. I think it's a misuse of the term. But the point of the matter is that many of the fisheries in the stock, although actually, interestingly enough, this 10%, isn't it, sounds reminiscent of Puget Sound salmon runs. I think we're at about 10% of historic runs here in Puget Sound as well. Now, this has tremendous implications for Filipinos. If you look at a place in the central Philippines, Alango Island off of Cebu, if you do historic reconstructions of what people caught per effort, catch per unit effort over time, basically what you see is a rather discouraging trend over time.
and introduction of destructive fishing methods, fine mesh nets. With the advent of plastic nets, it's completely transformed the way that people fish. And people are now having to work, and goodness knows what it is today, but people having to work a long period of time to catch about 2 kilograms of fish to feed their family. How are we going to frame the message, and how are we going to develop resource management messages that resonate with people? So in my last 20 years of working in the Philippines, I found that focusing on food security is one way that makes a lot of sense to Filipinos. We can talk about biodiversity, we can talk about the importance of coral reefs. Perhaps if you link it to tourism and opportunities for tourism, that makes make sense to Philippine coastal inhabitants. Most of the time, however, linking it to food security is quite important. In coastal communities, approximately 50% of people's animal protein comes from the ocean. So another important message is how, what's your message going to be and what's relevant to people in these contexts? Now, a lot of times when I give this lecture, people come away from it sort of thinking, well, geez, what a, and I'm going to use strong language here, what a pathetic place. What a place with complete lack of sort of self-control, self-restraint. It's just a morass of political problems. We get coup d'etats, and people don't want to use birth control, and people just seem sort of uncontrolled. Well, your lens might really focus on the Philippine level and sort of saying, you know, if Filipinos could sort of just get their act together, these things would be improved. Well, have you ever gone to a pet store in Seattle, an aquarium fish store for saltwater fish? About 80% of those fish come from the Philippines, and the vast majority of them are caught with sodium cyanide. You go to the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, the London Aquarium, most of those fish, those are tropical coral reef fish are caught with sodium cyanide. The very place that people go to learn about coral reef ecology, they're looking at animals that are caught with poison. And so, well-intentioned people who love coral reefs are basically buying fish from this very poor individual who's skirting a solution of sodium cyanide, which affects the fish much like it does people. It affects their respiratory processes. The fish becomes disoriented. And literally, you can pick the fish up, put it in a baggie, and as long as you put O2 in it relatively quickly, the fish will rejuvenate. Most of the fish, about 90% of the fish, die in transit. We're talking of hundreds of millions of organisms being sent to the United States, which is the largest market in the world for this, and the vast majority of them die in a baggie on the way here. And once they're in your tank, if you ever thought, well, why is it so hard to have a saltwater tank? All the fish I spent $40 on seem to croak within a month. Well, all their internal organs are damaged. And yet, I've had students look at this side of the equation, you know, how can we raise awareness about this? How can you do certified trade? I was contacted by a federal prosecuting attorney who wants to start going after some of this stuff using the Lacey Act. The fact of the matter is that the U.S. government hasn't wanted to problematize this trade at all. They haven't wanted to really engage in this. It's like, well, that's a problem over there. We're just buying the fish. Same thing with live fish for the Chinese food trade. For example, you go to Hong Kong or many of the Chinese restaurants, I would encourage you not to eat those pretty groupers that are in those big tanks that you select the fish out, because the vast majority of those as well, if you're traveling in Asia, can cause cyanide. There's also a very important human rights issue here, because this guy doesn't have a tube in his mouth, but most of the time he'll be diving off of an air compressor, a hookah, which is essentially the kind of air compressor you use to fill your tires with. And frequently, I've lived with cyanide fishing communities for a few years, good friends who are cyanide fishermen. And these guys are diving, 150 feet for an hour. They're so far off the dive tables, these people eventually have brain damage, they become restricted to wheelchairs, they get bent. That's a huge, it's a tragic trait, and much of the American public doesn't even really know about it. So, not to be too heavy, but that's reality. So, the question I'm really interested in is, yes, the resources are disappearing. Yes, this is a huge problem for biodiversity. It's a huge problem for food security. Personally, I think when we really, the challenge ahead of us with resource management is to try to figure out mechanisms and forms of resource management that will be received by people appropriately, welcome. Of course, resource management requires certain changes. In fact, my experience in the country has been Filipinos are clamoring for resource management. They want it to be just and equitable and transparent. So that's the challenge for the organizations that I work a lot with. I do a lot of consultant work for the World Bank, USAID, the Nature Conservancy, CI. The field is full. And many times people will think, well, let's just set really big parks. Well, most people, and I can show you this empirically, will see that as the next round of colonialism. I would suggest to you an approach to conservation like that will have a very short life. So I'm going to talk about what I study a lot of, focus on marine protected areas. I focus on this and because it's a tool that's commonly used in Southeast Asia. It's a tool that a lot of organizations around the world are rolling out to really try to save the ocean, if you will. There have been international agreements now agreed at international conferences that 20% of the ocean by 2020 should be in some form of marine protected area. And right now for coral reefs, it's less than 0.5%. So we are talking about a major effort within the next decade. We won't make that 20% figure will not be made by 2020 by all projections. But the fact of the matter is there's a huge push in the marine environment to start setting aside areas off limits to fishing. And so it's a favorite tool in some cases by the international community, but also in the Philippine context. And I had experience. I mean, I spent 3 years working with a fishing community in a very participatory planning process in from 1987 to 1990 at the early stages of marine protected area implementation in the country. And so I would hope you also don't get the sense that I'm an absolute critic. A lot of my research is about trying to sort of unpackage the assumptions around conservation movements. I teach a course called 4433 right now for the Jackson School and POE and the like, and we looked at the discourse around conservation, marine conservation especially, and forest conservation in the third world. But if any concerns that I raise about this, I try to do it in a constructive way. My hope is that the marine conservation and the marine protected area agenda flourishes, succeeds in a way that resonates with people from the developing world. So I'm going to talk about some of this work that I've been doing. So the starting point for me is to look at the literature. Now, if you work in the marine conservation world, there are certain demigods in this field. Archetype scientists, if you will. You know, when National Geographic goes, or the Seattle Times goes and interviews someone about the future of the oceans, I'm going to get on my high horses here a little bit, it's remarkable. The informants about the future of the ocean and the governance of the ocean are who? Biologists. Which I find, frankly, bizarre. Because governance is a social question. It would be like asking a sociologist to do a stock assessment. What's your opinion about the future of stocks in Puget Sound? Ask a sociologist? No. Ask a fisheries scientist. If you talk about the governance of the oceans, why would we go to an ecologist? They're not formally trained in it. And yet, the most influential papers determining the discourse in marine conservation is started by people like Daniel Pauly, Boris Berman, and the like, Jeremy Jackson. And these are interesting papers, and very important papers. I'm not trying to take anything away from the science. They're talking about fishing down stocks. They're talking about fishing down marine food webs. Very important. But I would suggest a little bit... It's interesting how this good science has now bled over to pretty remarkable recommendations around the human realm. One interesting outcome of some of these hard-hitting papers has been the adoption of marine ecosystem-based management. And this is a policy position paper that was circulated around the planet stating we need more ambitious resource management initiatives. We need to really take into consideration ecological function. And I've done a lot of literature review about this, published about this topic. A lot of this, while it maintains the balance or interest in the human dimensions, the marine interventions, and the ecology recommendations, frankly speaking, as a person who studies the sociology of science, This is essentially an ecologist agenda, the future of the ocean. It's really important to realize that even though 200 people signed this, the majority of the people who are comfortable with this agenda are either, if they are social scientists, they're economists. They're not anthropologists, they're not sociologists. They're mostly people who are looking primarily at maintaining ecological function in the ocean. Now, don't get me wrong, we all realize that ecological function is important. But placing that front and center in the framework for management of the ocean implies certain outcomes and will result in the selection of certain tools over others. So, for example, when we look at how organizations like the Nature Conservancy and the like have launched these enormous new marine conservation initiatives. These are very ambitious initiatives. The Nature Conservancy now has a budget larger than the Red Cross. This is a large organization. And so many of them are looking again to these very influential scientific papers that are saying, here's what we should do. And at the last paragraph of those papers in Science and Nature, they say, global network of marine protected areas. Without much real science about how this might be received, I would suggest. So what is a marine protected area? This is a very simplified, well-known model. Essentially what it means, and they use different terminologies in different locations, essentially what it means is setting aside a part of the ocean to not extract resources from. Now there are all kinds of types of marine protected areas. The context in which I work, it means a no fishing zone. And then the idea of this is that larvae and fish will then be dispersed outside the no fishing area. It's a little different than terrestrial systems where there's not such a highly mixed environment. And I would suggest, again, maybe a little bit provocatively, is that the ecology of this is rather elementary. You don't fish in a place and the fish get bigger. They reproduce. And yet we spent the vast majority, actually I just reviewed a paper about this, if you look at the published literature around marine reserves, about 95% of the peer-reviewed publications are about, does this happen? Almost no studies about governance, institutions, how people respond to it, what do they think about it. It's as if we're just completely mesmerized by the genetics, the spillover effect. And personally, I think it's unfortunate in many ways. So we don't spend enough time understanding how people and institutions will respond. So this is the context in which I work. I studied with this Pew Fellowship. I was one of only a couple social scientists. Most of them are ecologists. I think that there's now three of us out of a school of about 100 over the last 30 years. I'm using my Pew Fellowship money to study 36 community-based marine protected areas. This is the central part of the Philippines. This is Bohol. This is Cebu Island. And this is the kind of context in which I'm working. And believe it or not, despite the poverty and high population levels, communities like that are saying, we will give up 10 to 20% of our fishing grounds. Because we know if we do this, our kids will have a better future. Or maybe we'll get some tourism. So in notable contrast to what's going on in Puget Sound, we have almost no marine protected areas. In the Philippines, there are now over 700 community-based marine protected areas. Now, not all of those are successful, of course, but this is a place where people, this kind of intervention makes a lot of sense. The question is who's making the decisions? So my work was done in these communities in these 36 locations. And now I'm going to get into the research aspects here. So I'm real interested at the linkages between the social and the ecology. And I think that we have to reframe how we do our research in many regards to be able to really understand both dimensions if we want to be able to inform resource management in an effective way. So one of the ways that we do this, and I've done this work, I do both my in-water work, my visual censusing of fish, I kind of like bird counting underwater. So I collect the biological data. We've done longitudinal inside and outside surveys of these fish populations. In this talk, given the time, I'm only going to be able to actually talk more about the human dimensions research that we're doing in this context. So we did, a few years ago, 500 interviews of fishers, community project participants, community leaders, local government officials, et cetera. The questions in this questionnaire were about context, process, leadership, condition of the environment. These very formalized, structured interviews, different interview types for different types of individuals. But basically what we're trying to do is use the strength of the survey to identify general principles. But and then we use statistical analysis, basically multivariate statistical analysis, to tease out relationships between different variables. And I'm a big believer in multiple methods. So I come out of the school of qualitative research, ethnographic research as well. I think it's really important to maintain the narrative in the research. So I'm a big believer not only maintaining social and ecological, but also within the social science research, maintaining disciplinary balance, trying to complement quantitative work with qualitative work. So now I'm going to give some actual results. So one of the main desired outcomes of these marine protected areas is increased fish outside the no-take area, the so-called spillover effect that was in that slide earlier. Fishers are generally very good observers of the ocean. Whether or not they're going to support a marine protected area is based on their perceptions. And we can actually corroborate this kind of research with actual in-the-water research, which I'm not going to be able to do right now. But when we ask individuals, we ask a series of questions. How many fish were in the water 10 years ago outside the no-take area, and how many are in the water today? And then we simply just subtract those numbers, and we can use that as a third variable to show a perceived increase or decrease, in some cases, of fish. So I'm going to very quickly run through these correlations. And these are only correlations, so they don't infer causality. They're just saying these two variables are correlated with one another. And we can look at contextual variables based on our survey research. So I'm going to read through these. These are all going to be Spearman correlation coefficients. These are all the statistically significant ones based on these asterisks. So when people sense threat from illegal commercial fishing coming into their area in either during or prior to the MPA establishment, over time they perceived an increase of fish outside the no-take area. When the marine protected area is further away from the municipal center, there's a correlation between this variable and this variable. When there's a clear leader from the marine protected area, there's a strong positive relationship between clear leadership and perceived increase of fish. There's a negative correlation, however, between population size and this. And I guess if you're a strict Malthusian, you'd say that makes a lot of sense. One could also say that this is a proxy variable for complexity in these communities. So all of these variables are contextual variables that came out of us looking at probably 40 to 50 variables, and these are the ones that came out as statistically significant. This one is particularly interesting from a sociological point of view, and it's not surprising in many ways. People are not willing to take as radical a step as giving up some of their fishing ground until they, in fact, feel threatened. There needs to be the impetus of concern. Now, we can also look at process and management types of variables. With increased compliance, there is an increased perception of increased numbers of fish. With increased enforcement, similarly, when there's strict punishment of rule infractions around the marine reserve, this is correlated with perception of increased fish. Local community enforcement, group strength. These MPAs are actually locally enforced. Local deputized fishermen patrol the marine protected area and basically will enforce the rules. When there is improved skill levels of the municipal government, there's a perceived increase of fish. When the local NGO working with the community is doing a good job and they have high skill levels, that's also correlated. Interestingly enough, however, this notion that all boats rise the same is not true. Even when there are more fish in the area, there is, empirically we can show, more conflict, because the question is who gets what? I'm not going to have time to go into a lot of my research actually is around conflict. So the issue of where the fish go and who gets the benefits is actually quite a complex one. So those are only correlations. We then use regression analysis to try to really tease out predictive relationships between dependent variables like perceptions of increased numbers of fish and which independent variables are best predictors of this perception of increased numbers of fish. And these three variables came out in our stepwise multiple regression. Leadership, the strength of the local enforcement group, and the sense of threat from outside forces. And this is highly statistically significant, obviously. It explains quite a bit of the variance in our dependent variable. The reason I'm interested in doing this work is there's this notion in the marine conservation community and occasionally in donors is, well, let's just really focus on enforcement. Let's give the guys guns. Let's give them boats. They'll really be able to hold the line then. Well, the fact of the matter is that, sure, enforcement is an important variable, but other human capacity needs are also really important variables as part of having a well-governed marine conservation initiative. Leadership was identified in that regression analysis as important. This is an output, and I thank Circe for this in the back of the room. Basically, this is what's the outcome of something referred to as social network analysis. We asked questions of local people. Who do you go to talk to about the marine reserve, and who do you go talk to about fishing? And then we can use a statistical package, UCINET, and basically create these interesting dendritic sort of trees where you basically show that these individuals talk to certain individuals. And what you see when we do this around a marine protected area is that there are very clear patterns. And you can do statistical analysis about these patterns. The fact of the matter is that there are important leaders in these communities, as the regression analysis showed, and this has important messages for how we roll out these programs, as well as how we develop education programs. It also implies, though, when you have high concentration of dependence on certain leaders, what happens when this person gets burned out, gets tired, or, in the most drastic case, is killed? This informant, who I did an interview of, who had started local Bangtai Dagat groups in the central Visayas, had stopped a lot of the illegal fishing, Jojo de la Victoria. After this interview, where he said, I received many death threats, I never carry a firearm, me, if I'm authorized for me, it's enough that I'm doing right. This gentleman was assassinated about 2 years after I did this interview. It's never been proven by whom. Most people would believe it's the commercial fishing operations. These kinds of stories are unfortunately very, very common in the Philippines. People putting their lives on the line to stop illegal fishing. So, collaborative planning. From a sociological point of view, collaborative planning is all about people coming together and making decisions together. This is a bad slide. Basically, we use factor analysis to identify, to create one variable based on these three variables: mayors collaborating, inter-sanctuary management committee, and a coordinated enforcement. We created a fourth variable that's a new dependent variable. And then we did regression analysis based on that factor analysis variable. And these are the kind of variables that come out as the best predictors of good collaboration. And for good skill level among the local NGO, people being involved in training, human capacity development, and consultation with community during the planning. Basically, what this shows us is that participatory planning processes matter, and investing in skills development with people is a good investment. So when I give this talk, when I gave this talk at USAID and the World Bank, I'm like, look, guys, let's focus on things other than enforcement. Enforcement's important. Let's also invest in people. I'm not going to have time to go into that. These are narratives that support that. And I'm almost done here. Because I'm quite interested in conflict, there's a sort of tendency to overlook the challenges. So people adopt marine protective areas, they implement them, they actually get biological improvements. But in fact, it's a little more complicated than that. And in fact, conflict is not an uncommon component of these community-based conservation initiatives. So these are the regression analysis. When we turn a dependent variable like conflict into a dependent variable. And these are negative correlation coefficients. So I'm going to read these for you. As there's a perception that enforcement is fair, conflict goes down. As a community is consulted during the NPA planning process, conflict goes down. As the number of community groups increases, conflict goes down. As the community decision where the NPA is located, the conflict goes down. Again, the signal very clearly is that participation and well-designed participatory planning processes reduce conflict. So in conclusion, I'm involved in translating this work into education materials. We've been doing a series of trainings, working with these groups and these communities. I also do actually quite a bit of work in Puget Sound now with the tribes. And this summer I'll be doing a series of interviews around marine protected areas in Puget Sound. Believe it or not, the last study on governance of Puget Sound was done in 1972 by Bish. And this is crazy. We're spending $1 billion to save Puget Sound, and we haven't done any work on governance since the 70s. So we're going to be doing some work, some social survey research this summer. I'm also involved in establishing a marine park, a large marine park in the Philippine context, scaling up some of this work, but in a very collaborative way, trying to see if we can scale up some of the stuff to ecologically larger scales, but still maintaining the participatory planning processes. So, thank you very much. It's been good chatting. So the question is, if I understand, it's about how the Department of Natural Resources is going forward with the marine protected area work. They have a program called the Aquatics Reserve Program. A guy named Cal Murphy is now head of that program, and another David Palazzi. I've done some work with those guys, partly because I live on Vashon Island, where we have one of these aquatic reserves. All of the Intercorder Master Harbor, as well as Maury Island, was established as an aquatic reserve. Highly controversial. If you can read the newspaper about Glacier Northwest and the controversies around a large mine going in, it's been a very interesting case in the controversies around large extraction of mineral resources and what that means for the aquatic reserve. Subsequent to the Maury Island establishment and ones in other places in Puget Sound, they've gone forward with establishing ones up in Cherry Point, some of the San Juan Islands. What are my comments about it?
More specifically, how do you use
that's a very good question. I wish we could use it more. It's very difficult to get this kind of work funded. Look at the recent EPA grant RFP. Look at, and I got support from Sea Grant. Honey Dalton probably won't be happy that I say this, but if you look at the portfolio of funding from Sea Grant, it is very little of it is about human dimensions and governance. Very little. So the fact of the matter is that doing this kind of work is difficult. This summer, in fact, we're going to start studying the Aquatics Reserve Program. So we're going to do social survey research in Cherry Point and Vashon and Maury Island, and actually very similar to this. We're going to create dependent variables, and we're going to actually generate the dependent variables with DNR and say, what's a well-established aquatic reserve look like to you and to the local people? And we're going to measure all these independent variables about demographics and process. And then we're going to tell them, look, your success either goes up or down depending on whether you're attentive to these variables or not. And we can show you the p-value. And here are the narratives. The fact of the matter, to be very straightforward about responses, they've been flying in the dark. I mean, I've gone to all of those plantings, I've videotaped them, and they got in the back of the room with a video camera, watching people, making people nervous, interviewing people afterward. The fact of the matter is that they've gone forward with this program without really understanding what processes make for a good aquatic reserve in Puget Sound. And this is a very difficult context because of, and I work a lot with the tribes, so and I'm not, the tribes have basically said, we will not abrogate our treaty rights. We may choose to pay attention to these aquatic reserves, but every time we have gone, again, because they have usual custom fishing grounds, right? And those are spatially explicit. So if you overlay a no fishing zone on top of a IUU fishing area, or usual and custom fishing area, you're basically asking the tribe to abrogate their treaty right under the Bolt decision. The tribes, understandably, given the history, are not interested in that discussion. And yet DNR is kind of, and even the partnership, are kind of flying into this thing saying we're going to set up networks of marine protected areas over Puget Sound. And like I said, the last study was done in the 70s. I think a little bit has changed since the 70s. Please.
Do you think the decentralized form of marine fishery resource management is better or worse than more centralized bureaucratic?
I think it's impossible to make those kind of categorical decisions. The fact of the matter is that in the Philippine context, they're actually interested in some centralization. And so many of these marine reserves are at the scale of 50 hectares, 100 hectares, and there are issues with ecological processes. I mean, protecting migratory stocks, protecting large pelagic stocks. A 100 hectare MPA will protect a lot of the demersal sedentary stocks, but other animals, it won't. And also, there's issues of connectivity between these, and are there enough protected? So the Philippines is actually quite interested in trying to find mechanisms that are more centralized, but in a way that don't undermine the participatory process. And that's the challenge in the Philippine context. In the US, we have the exact opposite problem. I mean, as an activist and someone who's involved in Maury Island, et cetera, and doing empirical work in the US, what's really shocking to me in the US context is that while there's all these consultative planning processes under, and it's mandated by law, from my point of view, most of those public hearings are a sham. Everyone's scared about what to say. There's lawyers in the back of the room taking notes. NOAA and NIMS are scared to death about saying something. They're afraid they're going to get a lawsuit. I mean, it's all litigious. It's all, you know, we'll go, 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 and okay, see you in the court system. That's a very interesting way to make decisions. So actually, I think in the US context, we could do well to really learn from places like the Philippines and other contexts and try to figure out how can we begin to really engage people. It's in a sense, my take on this is that we've kind of divested as a society to say, okay, it's a decision for NIMS or a decision for DNR. And they'll invite us to some meetings, and then I'll see them once, and then I might see them a year from now, which is literally the planning process on Maury Island. They come maybe once a year, once every other year. That is not state-of-the-art marine protected area plan. You need a person on the ground full-time. It doesn't happen.
One more question.
Please.
What do you see as the future? How effective do you anticipate NPAs being in an area like Puget Sound where you have heavy industrial pollutants, heavy municipal runoff, and it's not so much as I understand necessarily an area or a consideration of strictly overfishing, it's the entire ecosystem that's falling apart. How much impact will NPAs have on that particular question?
That's a very good question, and in fact, some of the natural history of these organisms, I mean, they've had, you know, their stocks respond much slower here. I mean, in these areas, within 2 years, you can see a 100% increase in biomass. It's because it's a tropical system. Here we have long-lived species like rockfish, et cetera. Salmon swimming out, so is a spatial planning system really the right one? Clearly here, we probably take lots of different tools in the toolkit. I personally think because MPAs are not only about the biophysical attributes, and the fact of the matter of having the aquatics reserve in Vashon Maury Island has raised the bar on that island about a whole myriad of issues, including septic system and the gravel pit. Regardless of your opinion about Glacier Northwest, the fact of the matter is that that aquatic reserve has been an important part of the fight against glacier mining. And it's now raised, and people have said, well, what about all the people with their failing septic systems going into Quartermaster Harbor? Well, there's a novel program with state funding and federal funding to begin to examine that. And a lot of it is actually seen through the lens of the aquatics reserve. And so the bar has gone up for everyone. So, and in that case, it's not even a no-take reserve. It's just, let's improve the management. So I think in some cases, it's not going to be a panacea, and it should never be perceived as that. It is definitely one tool, and in some cases, I think looking at no-take aquatic reserve is actually really important and a tool in the toolkit.
Okay. So. All right. Thanks, Carol.